So, today's ad topic is Mel Science, M-E-L Science. So, I want to know, what is y'all's familiarity with Mel Science?
I know that Mel Science is a subscription service that offers monthly science boxes, which combines hands-on experiments with VR and AR technologies to engage kids in studying science.
And I know that they strive to make serious science accessible, interesting, and cool, which is a little bit like us.
We are interesting and cool.
And accessible. They offer a range of kits from Mel STEM at younger audiences all the way to Mel Chemistry. I didn't know this. Their starter kit actually for Mel Chemistry actually comes with a set of reusable beakers and a little stove to heat up and do reactions, which I think is awesome.
Sweet. I would have loved that so much as a kid.
This sounds like exactly what I would have been begging my parents for.
Yeah.
And I also didn't know that you can order it through Amazon, which is neat and convenient. And if you go to the link in the show notes and use the promo code EVERYTHING... Sorry, it felt weird not to say it in unison. EVERYTHING!
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 Can you sync us up? EVERYTHING!
Everything.
Sync us up in post. Yeah.
Sync this up in post. It's fine.
And if you go to the show notes and use the promo code
EVERYTHING,
you will save 60% off your first month of either Mel Physics, Mel Chemistry, or Mel STEM. But that offer is only valid for the next month. So
do it quickly. Oh my god. I need the boxes.
Time is ticking. So visit Mel Science in the show notes and use offer code EVERYTHING. And thanks, Mel Science, for sponsoring the show.
Thank you, Mel Science.
Buy their stuff.
We appreciate it.
We really appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Mics all records look good.
Yep.
Yes.
Cool. Loading up that theme song. Here we go, it's the theme song. This is the new theme song. I'm playing the file. It looks like I'm singing, but I'm actually playing the file. I know where it is. Here it is.
Wow, that was the best one so far.
I loved that.
Thanks.
Can that be our open one this time?
Yeah.
Theme song. This is the theme song.
Let's Learn Everything, the show where we learn anything and everything interesting. Today, we'll be covering a science topic, we'll be answering a question, and we will be hopping into a little miscellaneous topic. My name is Tom, and today's main topic is the Turing test.
Ooh. I'm excited about this.
I feel like the Turing test has been mentioned a few times over the course of the podcast, it'll be exciting to actually understand it.
Finally time.
Yeah, we're going to dig into some good old primary sources, which will be nice.
My name is Ella, and...
Hi, Ella.
Hi, Tom. Today's question is, what's wrong with Ella? What's wrong with Ella?
Are we going to be talking about, like, mental health stuff?
No, I thought maybe I wouldn't go that heavy with this question.
We appreciate that.
What? Hold on. Okay, no. What's the question again?
What's wrong with Ella?
I can't wait to figure it out. Tom's so confused, and I love it.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
Okay.
We'll get there. Tom.
Interesting.
Hi, my name's Caroline, and this episode's miscellaneous topic... Hi, Tom. This episode's miscellaneous topic is going to be a brief history of quizzes and pub quizzes.
Oh! Yes, good. After the crossword last week, this really... a good tie.
I thought we would stick to the theme.
Yeah, I'm going to have to think of a theme.
I want to add... speaking of crosswords, add a quick correction from the last episode, which is that I mistakenly said that the New York Times crossword included the answer noise, N-O-I-I-C-E, for the clue that said neat. And someone in the Discord, who was a former bartender, informed me that the answer was actually no ice. So,
it just makes a lot more sense.
I just want everyone to know that Will Shorts is not cool. So,
Boo.
Boo.
Boo hiss.
Oh, this is Corrections Corner now. Corrections Corner. Not that it's not technically a correction. It's just a clarification.
No, we're going to do a little clarification because somebody else in the Discord server rightly pointed out that some bonsai trees are much older than the potted plant at Kew Gardens. So the plant at Kew Gardens holds the world record because it's been so heavily documented. The bonsai trees in question have not been so heavily documented, so that's possibly why they're not counted. But also, we don't know when those bonsai trees were put into a pot, so that might be why they're not counted as part of the world record holder. Basically, they are absolutely correct. There are plants out there who have been in pots for longer than the one at Kew Gardens. There's just a few reasons why we don't count it as the world record holder. Thanks, guys.
Cool.
Neat. Lots of old plants. We love them all.
Nice.
Nice.
All right. Y'all ready for this? Do, 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 do. The main topic. Do, do, do. Turing test. So today, we're going to be talking about the Turing test, which, as someone who studied cognitive science and computer science in undergrad, is something I could not get away from if I tried. There are, frankly, too many papers on the Turing test. I think the biggest proof of this is if you go to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy page on the Turing test, you can find headings that read, "The Turing test is too hard. The Turing test is too easy. The Turing test is too narrow. Should the Turing test be considered harmful? The Turing test is always bailing on plans last minute. The Turing test never uses its turn signals. The Turing test takes forever to get its clothes from the dryer." Your Turing test really can't get a break is the point I'm trying to make. But I do want
classic
to ask y'all.
Classic Tom joke.
Love that. Comedy.
Thanks. I needed that the seal of approval on that, and or else it's not a joke. So do you all know what the Turing test is?
It's to see if something... Yes, I'm not even going to try and explain it because I will just say a load of
butcher
crap,
it so badly.
Yeah. Oh no, that's what I want to hear.
Okay.
I feel like the popular notion of the Turing test has almost become something in and of itself. So I'm very curious what y'all think.
Have you seen the film Ex Machina?
I have.
That's so good. I like this. Yeah.
That's a kind of Turing test, isn't it? Kind of.
Yes. Yeah.
Essentially trying to see if isn't it like if artificial intelligence is like like human like almost?
This is really interesting. This is really interesting because especially in sci-fi, the popular notion of the Turing test has really become like a feeling. Like we all have a feeling to it, but like the nitty gritty of it is something else. So yeah, rather than making you all squirm a bit more, let's just dig right into the sources. So Alan Turing, who is one of the most important figures in computing for like a dozen different reasons, writes a paper in 1950 that is it's just titled Computer Machinery and Intelligence. And you love a good understated title, because this is about to become, well, as one analysis written in the year 2000 put it, quote, "It is safe to say that no other single article in computer science and few other articles in science in general have generated so much discussion."
Wow.
I actually really love the original paper because it's really beautifully equal parts mathematical proof and equal parts philosophical argument. Like in one paragraph he's explaining how finite state machines work, and then in the other he's like questioning the nature of the human soul. I love shit like that. It is a bit dense, but if anyone is interested in this question, I think you should read it because it's really a historical source at this point. He addresses a lot of concerns, and it's really prescient for the time it was written, considering that at the time computers were like the size of a room and didn't have monitors. They just like printed out information. Anyway, the paper starts with this real fire starter of a sentence. He goes, "I propose to consider the question, can machines think?" And immediately,
that's like a novel opening. You know, it's not even like a paper. It's that I would read that sci-fi book.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And immediately he recognizes that, like, this question is a can of worms. And so what's clever is he proposes a way of answering that question by proxy, which he calls the imitation game. And so
there's a film with Benedict Cumberbatch in called it The is, Imitation
yeah.
Game.
where he plays Alan Turing, yeah.
Yes.
So he describes a game where the player, the judge, is asking questions of two people, a man and a woman. But the judge can't see the people. They only get written answers back. And both people are trying to convince the judge that they are a woman. And then he pivots and says, what would this game be like if instead it was one of them was a computer and they were both trying to convince the judge that they were human? And this is what gets to be known as the Turing test. First of all, I gotta say, I love that one of the most talked about articles in computer science includes this, like, subtle jab at the performative nature of gender. Amazing.
Yeah, I love that.
Not enough people talk about that aspect, but that's like a liberal arts thesis paper for another time. but yeah, like, the idea is, like, the act of conversing with a computer would be sufficient to prove its intelligence. How do y'all feel about that?
It's very subjective.
Yeah.
Which is, like, it kind of has to be, I guess. But also, yeah. I don't like that it is.
Intelligence. We say intelligence, not, like, humanness.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's, they're not, like, the same thing, right? You know, you can be an idiot and still be a human.
Wow.
But it's once well, you again... know. Oh, go on.
I feel like there are... You can fail all your SATs and still the human mind has a lot of aspects to it that are, like, deeply intelligent. Like, just memory, associations.
But, like, there's any part of, like, you, of being a human, any, like, of... There is someone out there who doesn't possess that, who you wouldn't say was any less human for not possessing it, right? Like, emotional intelligence or street smarts or, like... You know, the ability to read facial expression or express your emotions. You know, there's lots of things that individual humans can't do that we don't call them, then say they're not human.
It would be really offensive if we said they weren't human.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Also, it feels like a flashback to the maze topic again, where it was like...
Of course, yeah.
Like, how on earth can we use one test to gauge this? And the test is that? Like, I don't know, it raises a lot of red flags for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about conversing, and it's interesting that he mostly refers to it as, like, a game, which I think is very interesting. I think the popular notion has sort of turned it more into, like, a quantitative test, but I think the open-ended nature of it is really interesting. There's a quote where he goes... the question and answer method seems to be suitable for introducing almost any one of the fields of human endeavor that we wish to include. And this is also an interesting point. He goes, we do not wish to penalize the machine for its inability to shine in beauty competitions, nor to penalize a man for losing in a race against an airplane. So the idea of the game is basically to focus on a task that, you know, is fair to the machine, you know, because, like...
Okay, computer, let's do a fashion show. Whoever has...
we would lose that. I feel like that's...
Maybe you would. Have you seen my sexy nightgown I'm wearing right now?
I don't know. Have you seen some of the new IMAX?
Oh, my goodness.
But yeah, do you see what I'm trying to say there, aside from the fashion point?
I guess what I want to know is, what are the criteria of the test?
So I think, and what's really kind of interesting, I think is an interesting point, is that, like, this is explained more as, like, a thought experiment than, like, a really explicit test. Like, he's not saying that, like, I think he makes a there's this one number that a lot of people stick to, which is at one point he makes a prediction that he says in 50 years, I believe that 30% of the time, you know, within a 5-minute conversation with an AI, you won't be able to tell the difference 30% of the time. And, you know, some people really stick to those numbers. But in my opinion, I think this is more meant as a guidelines for thinking about it, right? It's like, it's not about like he doesn't specify a question, right? It's not like, once a computer can answer what is love correctly, then we can, it's sort of a general nature of like, if a bunch of people talk to it and ask whatever questions they want to ask, then that might be it. I will also say this doesn't have to be, you know, satisfactory to all of y'all, and we're going to talk about some of the like,
well, then why are we talking about it if I won't find it satisfying?
There is one question that I would love to ask y'all, which is what questions you would ask a computer in this, if you were the judge in this imitation game.
Ooh. Do you
like the podcast?
You know, I'd go pretty basic. What is love?
That's so hard because I feel like even I couldn't answer that question.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I don't think most students can. Hold on, wait a second.
No, hold on. I can, and Ella can, if Carolyn can't.
Neither of you have ever seen me in real life. Does this mean I'm artificial intelligence?
Maybe. Maybe we all are. Maybe it's three maybe AIs talking around in circles.
Oh, don't do this to me because I'll literally, like, fall down such an existential crisis if we have that conversation right now.
Well, I think I would ask it like, what? No, you know what? I just don't have anything. Like, I've talked to too many AIs now in my life that the conversations are just so dumb.
Yeah, no, and it's interesting because, like, I feel like even we, as people in the year 2022, have interacted with, like, chatbots, like Cleverbot, were y'all ever big into that?
Yeah.
And it's interesting how quickly I lose interest in them, right? You ask, you say hi, you say like, how is your day? Are you a human? So let's get into some of the nitty gritty of this and the sides of this argument. So over the years, there have been so many discussions about this paper. I found a reflection from the year 2000 that said, quote, only 13 years after Turing's article appeared, Anderson had already counted over 1,000 published papers on whether machines could think.
Wow.
That is a lot of retweets and subtweets from academia. There's a particularly scathing account.
I'm sorry, that's what citations are. That's what citing someone in a reference in a paper is now. It's a subtweet. Yeah. Jesus.
It's a subtweet.
Yeah.
Lame.
I hate this.
There's a particularly scathing account from Blay Whitby in 1997 that describes the Turing test as four stages. He goes, first, it was, quote, a source of inspiration to all concerned with AI. Then it was a distraction from some of the more promising avenues of AI research. Then, by now, a source of distraction, mainly to philosophers rather than AI workers. And finally, consigned to history. I feel both ways about the sentiment. I think that the Turing test is a really valuable metaphor, right? I think especially during its time, it was raised a valuable question about considering not just the mathematics of technology, but also the like philosophy and psychology of technology, right? And I think it's also a really great stepping stone into deeper questions of AI, which is why I think it's so prevalent in media. Famously, the Voight-Kampff test in the movie Blade Runner is a conversation with a robot that is meant to weed out androids from humans. And so I think it's very valuable on that point. I think that's the reason why we all know it sort of on a gut level. But on the other hand, sort of to what we've talked about, I think in the year 2022, we sort of live in a world that has chatbots, right? Like Cleverbot and like other chatbots have actually like quote unquote like passed the Turing test, and you can find articles after article about that. And you know, it's sort of like AI's version of constantly rediscovering that there's water on Mars. I feel like there's been so many articles that's like, it's passed the Turing test, but none of it feels like, it all feels hollow, right? Like none of us are ever like, we live in a world where we can talk to robots.
No, yeah. It's not Blade Runner.
It's not exactly. That's no. That's a great way to put it. And so this brings up a really interesting problem in AI that's known as the alignment problem. So I first learned about this from AI researcher and fellow science communicator Robert Miles. So many thanks to him. So when it comes to artificial intelligence, one type of problem you can run into is something called a capability problem. That's like, does a computer have the resources, the time, the computing power to accomplish something? So if you sent like a Google engineer back in time to 1950, they would not have the data, the compute power to make the complex AIs that they know how to design, right? Like that is a capability problem. But the other kind of problem you can run into in AI is something called an alignment problem. And some people think that that's what's happening with the Turing test. So an alignment problem is when the goal of the AI and the goal of the AI's designer are not aligned. So a simple way to think of this is if you've ever taken a class in school that felt like you were learning to take the test more than you were learning the material,
right.
That's an alignment problem. And very similarly, some people think that building chatbots for the Turing test is studying for the test rather than trying to learn intelligence. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really beautiful phrase that The Economist used in 1992. They were covering an AI that was trying to pass the annual Loebner Turing test competition. And basically, they saw that chatbots were often throwing in typos into their responses to appear more human.
Wow.
And the Economist called this, quote, artificial stupidity. And true to that point, this is exactly what happened in 2014 when the biggest Turing test news story in recent history broke. And it was in every news outlet. I don't know if y'all, at least in the computer science and cognitive science world, like I could not stop hearing this news. So this is from the BBC. A computer program called Eugene Goostman, which simulates a 13-year-old Ukrainian boy, is said to have passed the Turing test at an event organized by the University of Reading. Did y'all hear about this?
No.
So in my circles, we were so tired of hearing about this.
My circles, everyone was like, gosh, Eugene Goostman, Eugene, have you heard about Eugene? Of course.
Please don't bring up Eugene again. I'm so tired of Eugene. But truly, if you Google him, you will see every publication under the sun writing about this. So this chatbot, by having this persona of Eugene Goostman, was basically able to play dumb tricks on the judges. So like any grammatical errors or like non sequiturs could be interpreted as being a teenager who doesn't speak English as a first language.
Oh, that's a good idea. But obviously,
I think it's super clever.
Yeah, I mean, it's clever if you want to trick someone that you're human, but it doesn't. But then when you go off and just try and be human, you're not doing that. You're...
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It once again feels very hollow, yeah.
Exactly. I think it's clear to everyone that this is like a shallow victory, if only for the fact that like Eugene Goostman has not replaced Siri yet in the last decade. It's been a while.
Well, and Eugene should. Eugene sounds great.
clearly what's happening here is not a capability problem, right? Because like, I don't think running Eugene on a supercomputer is going to suddenly make him more intelligent, right? So
don't speak badly about Eugene like that.
All he needs is a few GPUs and then he can show you, he can really shine. I do want to be crystal clear. I actually do think that Eugene and these chatbots are actually interesting and they're worthwhile. Like, I'm glad Eugene Goostman exists. I think it raises a really interesting question into what fools us, because it's important to remember that the Turing test is as much about the judge as it is the computer playing the game, right? It's a game. I also think that the phrase artificial stupidity, even though it was originally said in a derogatory way, is a totally fascinating concept in AI, because like humans are stupid, especially compared to computers in a lot of ways, and sometimes meeting us at our level is valuable. That's a whole topic for another time, but I think this is pretty interesting. And also, like I said before, I think it's a good stepping stone for the public to get into deeper questions about AI and get interested in it.
Yeah.
But I do personally think it's true that with the imitation game being a metaphor, being a proxy question for the even harder question of whether machines can think, you're bound to have these kinds of alignment problems, right? But I don't think Eugene Goostman is the most interesting thing to come out of the Turing test, not by a long shot. And I don't even think that chatbots are, I don't think that either of those are actually the biggest misalignment problem to come out of the Turing test, because I've actually taken a page out of Carolyn's book, and I've kind of tricked you.
A twist!
I actually don't want to talk about...
Oh my god!
I don't want to talk about the Turing test. I want to talk about a Turing test, something that the Turing test has become. It's a Turing test that I can almost guarantee every listener to this has run into before, maybe even this week.
Oh my god, so, I know what it is. I know what it is.
I want to ask, do either of you know what the acronym CAPTCHA stands for?
I don't know what CAPTCHA stands for, but I knew you were going to say CAPTCHA. Caroline's just face is just like...
I have no clue. I'm so lost. What's CAPTCHA happening?
Caroline, you know what a CAPTCHA is, right?
No.
You've definitely
maybe don't know the name for it.
But maybe you don't know the name.
I've definitely done one. So I might not know the name.
CAPTCHAs are those tests where if you ever have to like log into an account or like set up something where they'll ask you, are you a human?
Yeah. Okay.
Sometimes they'll ask you to type in words. Sometimes they'll ask you to pick pictures. So I didn't know this. CAPTCHA stands for Completely Automated Public Turing Test to Tell Computers and Humans Apart.
Oh,
nice.
That's really cool.
Is it just one of those acronyms, though, that they were like, oh, it's like CAPTCHA, like, let's catch the bot and we'll make it sound, we'll make it fit into the...
I know, the first thing that I'm sure everyone is thinking is the acronym should really be CAPTCHA, because that's what that sentence is. It's CAP, four T's, CAHA. I don't know how they've gotten away with that acronym for so long. It's an acronym crime. Hire a poet, someone to write this better.
No, that's just how scientists do acronyms. They just they fit it in afterwards, although they just take random letters out of there.
So I've heard that term is actually called a backronym, where you come up with the acronym first and then backfill it in.
Oh,
I love
that.
I think it's unbearable and I love it. Anyway.
This is actually, Tom, can I just say before you get into CAPTCHAs,
yeah.
I'm so psyched you're talking about this, because every time I do one of the CAPTCHAs where it's like, click on all the pictures that have traffic lights or buses, and I'm like, why can't a computer do this?
But, yeah.
And then I started thinking, is it just the speed with which I do it? Because I probably do it slower than a computer. Because I'm like, does this bit of square have a bus in it?
So we'll get into it anyway. To get into the history of it, CAPTCHA was introduced in a paper written in 2003 by Von Ahn, Blum, Hopper, and Langford out of Carnegie Mellon University. And it was titled CAPTCHA, Using Hard AI Problems for Security. It's a great paper to read, actually. And they bring up a really hilarious example of why CAPTCHAs are necessary. So this is a quote. In November 1999, Slashdot.com released an online poll asking which was the best graduate school in computer science. Parentheses, a dangerous question to ask over the web. Students at Carnegie Mellon found a way to stuff the ballots by using programs that voted for CMU thousands of times. CMU's score started growing rapidly. The next day, students at MIT wrote their own voting program, and the polls became a contest between voting bots.
And wouldn't that show you that whichever one won was the best for computer science?
I would have thought so, yeah.
MIT finished with 21,158 votes, Carnegie Mellon with 21,032, and every other school with less than 1,000.
So MIT or Carnegie Mellon are the best schools, because they can do that.
There we go. Yeah.
I mean, listen, there's more to being a good programmer than just being a nuisance on the web. I know it doesn't seem like it in this world. I feel like every programmer loves to be a nuisance, but there are other reasons. Anyway, so they go, can the results of any online poll be trusted? Not unless the poll requires that only humans can vote. So the idea is that these tiny Turing tests can be made that will prevent spam bots with a problem that only a human could solve, which is not the exact definition of the Turing test, but it is very much in the spirit of the Turing test. And so the initial CAPTCHAs were... Oh, God, I just realized that we have listeners that maybe have never seen the old CAPTCHAs. But the old CAPTCHAs, I don't know if y'all remember.
Letters.
Yeah, they were basically an image of a word that was like warbly, like you put it in water. And at the time,
they do still exist on the internet, Tom.
Okay, good.
Yeah, they still exist.
And so, yeah, at the time, this was a difficult thing for AI to do, to recognize these characters, but it's something that we can read. And you know, I think computer vision has evolved a lot in the time, so it feels less difficult now, but at the time, that was the idea. And the first paragraph of this CAPTCHA paper reads, and listen carefully, because it's a doozy, they go, "We introduce CAPTCHA, an automated test that humans can pass, but current computer programs can't pass. Any program that has high success over a CAPTCHA can be used to solve an unsolved artificial intelligence AI problem." Now, I want to unpack that because I said it quickly, but to paraphrase, what they're saying is, we will offer AI problems as tests, and if an AI can pass it, then great, we just solved an AI problem. Which is... that's like an astounding amount of optimism, right? It's like saying, we designed this lock to be unpickable, but if someone can pick it, that's amazing! We have new lock-picking technology!
I kind of get it.
I do. It's...
Yeah.
it is an optimism, though, you know? So this idea obviously took off, and now the internet is... kind of weird to think about, is basically peppered with these deeply philosophical questions that are being used as a functional roadblock. But where this really gets interesting is when one of the authors of the paper, Louise Van Aan, gets a MacArthur grant to start a project called ReCAPTCHA, which is what most CAPTCHAs are these days. So he was interviewed in 2009 about it, and the reporter said, quote, so this is Louise describing how he feels about the word CAPTCHAs he helped invent. He realized that he had unwittingly created a system that was frittering away in 10-second increments millions of hours of a most precious resource, human brain cycles. With the help of a MacArthur genius grant, Van Aan set out to make amends. So he felt bad that everyone was just solving these like meaningless word problems every time. And so what the change he made was he tried to use CAPTCHAs to solve archival optical character recognition, or OCR. So what ReCAPTCHA did, did was they said, hey, if you're working on an archival project where you're trying to like digitally scan books, articles, whatever, give us your bad scans of the words that are like smudged or crumpled.
That's so good.
Isn't that so cool? And we will use them in our CAPTCHAs.
Oh my god, that's fucking, wow. That's actually so, that's amazing.
That's
so I would do, I'm happy to do word letter CAPTCHAs if that is the...
Well, no. Yes.
No.
I agree.
Tom.
But we'll get into it. So what they do, right, is most CAPTCHAs are two words of this kind, right, of like the word kind. And what they would do is the first word would be a regular CAPTCHA, just like to test you to see if you're accurate. And then the second one would be a word from a scan of a book or an article. And the reason this works is because what you do is you don't trust like one person to answer. But if like 10 people all say the same word for that, then like it's probably right. Like if everyone was doing the first word correct and then the second word gibberish, if they were all different gibberish, then obviously you can't trust it. But if everyone says it's the same word, then you have a high probability.
Yeah.
And also, like, worst comes to worst, like, a word is slightly wrong, which is not the end of the world.
Mm. This is actually so great.
That's so good.
So, famously, the New York Times archive of all their articles was powered by a lot of ReCAPTCHA work. And for a while, this was, like, a big selling point of ReCAPTCHA. Do you guys remember the like when they used to, I don't know if you remember, they used to be like red bordered ReCAPTCHAs, and they're actually for a while used to say stop spam, read books. Like that was like their gimmick was like, we're doing like a cool thing.
I feel like I do remember that, yeah.
Yeah. But this is where it gets sad.
Oh no.
The reason you don't see it anymore is because in 2009 a little company called Google
Boo hiss.
Acquires Boo. Recaptcha for what is reported as somewhere between $10 and $100 million.
Oh, just somewhere in
just
that
somewhere
range.
Just somewhere in that range, you know.
Yeah.
Also, I gotta say, this is a really quick side note. This is absolutely wild. So, Louise Van Aan, who worked on the original Captcha and then worked on Recaptcha, also went on to create a little language app called Duolingo.
Oh, wow.
It is a small world.
And the only reason I bring this up is because if you ever see one of the Duolingo Owls TikToks where they're trying to court Dua Lipa, just remember, you have Alan Turing to thank for that.
That's very good. So the TikTok I watched, I think today, where the Duolingo Owl is pretending to swim in Dua Lipa's urine.
Uh-huh.
That's because of Alan Turing.
That's because of Alan Turing, yeah. Indirectly. But yes, yeah. So, as Ella noted, you may have noted that captchas have evolved from words to images and gotten worse, taken more time.
Oh God, they take so long now. Like, honestly,
yeah.
Because I'm really bad at captchas. I was bad at the word captchas because I just couldn't perceive the words properly. I mean, if you're dyslexic, it must be terrible. But, and now the picture ones, I click all of the wrong things and they're like, let's do that five
times.
I'd
like to make the point of, like, if you're visually impaired in
absolutely.
Any way.
Well, they do the...
Yeah.
These are impossible, like...
Do the sound ones, don't they, still?
They
well,
do,
Well, they do,
are...
but there's actually a study I found that the sound ones are objectively more difficult.
Oh, no.
Like, they are worse, because they don't spend as much time on them.
Yeah. Of course, yeah.
Like, a few weeks ago, I was working on some... financial forms with my dad, and it was really tense, and we got to a captcha and I was filling out and he was like, you missed one, and I was like, oh, I missed one, dad. It almost turned into like a whole thing, because I was like, we were already like, and I was like just let me forgive me, just get off my fucking back. Like, I'm
doing it. You heard it here, captchas break up families,
tearing families apart. Yeah. No, I love my dad dearly. Love you, dad. So, again, part of this is because of the fact that, like, AI is getting better at beating captchas. But also, part of it is because of something else. So, if you go to ReCAPTCHA's page now, that belongs to Google, not its main page, mind you, but like a side page, you'll find a description that reads, ReCAPTCHA offers more than just spam protection. Every time our captchas are solved, that human effort helps digitize text, annotate images, and build machine learning datasets. This in turn helps preserve books, improve maps, and also solve hard AI problems.
Like what?
Exactly. That's a great question, Ella. Now, a logical follow-up question to this is, hey, Google, what machine learning datasets? What hard AI problems? And the answer is, that's proprietary.
So you're basically... to access things, forcing people to solve questions that you're not allowed to know.
Correct. That's exactly right, Ella.
I just tell you, this is... okay, so there's this TV show on Apple right now called Severance. It's a science fiction show that has a lot of elements to it, but one of the things is the workers are sat in front of a computer with a bunch of numbers, and it's encoded, it's encrypted numbers, and when they have to solve the encryption... not to figure out what it says, but just if it's good or bad. And they have no idea where it's going. And I'm like, they don't know what it means, and they don't know what they're removing or adding in. And that's just accepted. And I'm kind of starting to think the people who wrote this based this on captcha. On Google's
captcha.
Sounds so similar.
There's also stories of captcha farms and captcha services where you can outsource solving captchas to human beings for like fractions of pennies. Anyway, I just want to point out that like in the year 2022, this idea is almost normalized, right? That like Google would be doing something like this. But I want to take a quick step back and like put this into context. Do you guys know the meme where it's like, me going back in time and showing a 1600s kid what hyperpop sounds like? Have you seen those where it's like, what would it be like to show a kid from like 500 years ago like what like a Marvel movie looks like, or like what dubstep sounds like? This is exactly that. Like in 1950, Alan Turing lived in a world where computers were the size of a room And he hoped that maybe in 50 years from now, computers would have like astounding like megabytes of processing power and be able to converse with people and show intelligence. And in 2022, millions of people distributed across the whole world all have computers and participate in Turing tests to improve artificial intelligence for a single company to do undisclosed research on artificial intelligence.
I really hate this. I actually really hate this.
So,
right, oh, man.
For me, originally, like, the most interesting thing about the Turing test has always been it uses technology to ask a question about human psychology and philosophy, right? But what the Turing test has become has raised a question about how technology interacts with society. That's right. This whole time, this topic was about society.
No.
I tricked you.
Yay.
But I really do actually mean that. So one way we can think about this is as an alignment problem, right? The stated objective, the purported objective of reCAPTCHA is to train intelligent AI. But the actual test of a reCAPTCHA in practice is what is the cheapest way to get a lot of free training done, right? There are like deeply economic and sociological incentives causing this misalignment, right? And so like much in the same way that like we asked ourselves, is the Turing test aligned with intelligent AI? We have to ask ourselves, are social and company and profit motives aligned with intelligent AI? And I think it's a gross misalignment. And I'm actually not the only one that thinks that. There's a perfect case study of this, this sort of like sociological misalignment problem in something called GitHub Copilot. So for those who don't know, GitHub is the biggest website for hosting code. It's like the YouTube of code. And GitHub Copilot is an AI that was trained on GitHub code to be able to predictively help you write your code. So it analyzed all of this free publicly hosted code to learn to write code. And if you watch demonstrations of this as a programmer, it's like literally looks like magic. It's like autocomplete for entire lines of code. It's really nuts. But of course, there's a misalignment problem here between Copilot learning to produce good code and learning to regurgitate public code they were able to get for free because they own the platform. And there was a paper that came out in 2021 from Chen et al. Titled Evaluating Large Language Models Trained on Code. And it looked at the model behind GitHub Copilot, which is called Codex. And they say, quote, "We conclude that we have identified misalignment in Codex models." So paper goes on to say, "It's important to study misalignment because it is a problem that is likely to become worse, not better, as the capabilities of our systems increase. For example, the model size scaling trend for the example in figure 12 indicates that misalignment would likely persist and even get worse if data parameters and training time were scaled up." Basically, what they're saying is giving Eugene more power would not make him a smarter 13-year-old. While we expect that misalignment behavior like this is unlikely to cause significant harm in current models, it is likely to become more dangerous and harder to eliminate as model capabilities increase. A highly capable but sufficiently misaligned model trained on user approval might produce obfuscated code that looks good to the user, even on careful inspection, but in fact does something undesirable or even harmful.
But in that case, it would imply the presence of like a bad actor giving the thing harmful code.
Well, no, this is again sort of the misalignment, which is that the code that's hosted on GitHub doesn't have to be good, right? It just has to be there. And so what they're finding is that like if you start typing bad code, it's going to autocomplete with
bad code.
More bad code. But worse, what they talk about is giving it more power might make it the worst situation is code that looks superficially good but is actually bad and like could cause an exploit or a problem. Basically, what they're saying is that like don't give Eugene more power, please God, don't give Eugene more compute power because like he's not gonna handle it well. And you know, when you're making these alignment decisions based on either corporate profit motivation or from a lack of understanding of, like, or consideration of societal factors, you're going to have these alignment problems. But the one thing I want to mention, I think the clearest example of how society affects technology and science is actually in the story of Turing himself. So anyone who's dug into the discourse around Turing tests might notice that there's actually a voice that is absent from a lot of discussions, and that is Turing himself. And that's because 2 years after he publishes this famous paper, this most talked about paper in all of computer science, he would be tried for homosexual acts and then went through some absolutely horrific stuff and then passed 2 years later. So technology has always been a social issue as well as a scientific issue. Like, 2 years earlier or later, and that paper just, like, doesn't exist. And who knows what we've missed out on because of this. I want to say, in spite of all of that, in spite of bringing us down a little bit, and in spite of all the technology bashing, I do want to say I am a tech optimist. I think AI ethics is a really rapidly expanding field that is really, really fascinating. Timnit Gebru is an amazing voice in the field. Hannah Fry's book, Hello World, is really great. And as I mentioned in this episode, Robert Miles does really awesome videos on the subject of AI ethics. And I think it's really interesting. And, like, when Turing proposed the Turing test, it caused a lot of debate. It caused a lot of doomsayers, but it also sparked a lot of good progress. And I think the story of what the Turing test has become can hopefully do the same. So I want to end with my favorite line from Turing's paper, which is actually the very last line of the paper. And it goes, again, I do not know what the right answer is, but I think both approaches should be tried. We can only see a short distance ahead, but we can see plenty there that needs to be done.
Aww.
So that's the Turing test.
We love Alan Turing on this pod.
We do.
Even more so than Eugene, I would say.
I do love Eugene, though.
Yeah. it's very close.
It's very close, but he does.
I'll be honest, incredibly fascinating topic has opened a whole, like, load of questions to me. Like, yeah. Things that I think you can't mm-hmm. answer. It's not your fault, but just there is a lot of unexplained things here. The Google thing has really fucked me up.
Yeah,
that's awful.
That's heavy.
Yeah.
I think the first step is being like, hey, this is happening.
I think knowing,
we should all
right.
We all deserve to know this.
Knowing about it is
definitely.
I think we're, you know, Caroline and I are pretty switched on people. I had no idea that kind of thing was. And I don't think that's common knowledge.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm. Yeah, and it's very interesting to sort of think about what is taken for granted. And I think, you know, if you spend enough time in these worlds, you start to think, like, maybe this is okay. And sometimes, no, that's actually not.
No.
It's important to consider this. Yeah. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of people doing really, really inspiring work pushing against these big forces. And yeah.
Fuck you, Google.
Yeah, I feel pretty confident saying that.
So, to reiterate today's question, it is, what's wrong with Ella?
Ella, do we mean you?
We mean me and any other people that fit into the categories of things that we're going to get into. This is a series of basically gentle medical questions.
Are we playing 20 medical questions, but with your medical diagnosis?
Also, hold on. is the question, like, what is, like, Ella syndrome? Like, what are the
that
context?
That would be good,
of...
yeah. Can we come up with a list of symptoms that makes you Ella? That's the...
I do want to ask, like, right off the bat, like, there aren't any, like, serious... Like, you're not about to be like,
no.
Well, one of them is five types of cancer.
You're not dying, right? Just to confirm.
Well, hold on, Carolyn. We're all dying.
Okay.
Oh, please.
I don't
hate
need
it when,
existential crisis number two today.
That. It's not true. We're not all dying, okay? We're not dying until about 27. So...
So there.
That's, I mean,
so I have
well,
2 weeks.
So just me then? also, Also, all our older than 27 listeners are just rolling their eyes. I swear to God.
I did run this. I ran. I always tell people what I'm doing on the podcast, my friends, and they were like, I said, this is my question. They were like, oh, no, you're not going to talk about the fact that you're depressed, are you? I was like, no, that's probably a bit much for the podcast. What we're going to talk about.
But we all had the thought.
What I want you guys to try and answer is bodily quirks that you might have some of, but that a lot of our listeners may also have. So I have about 5 or 6 questions that we can go through. And that there is that you will see a running theme as we go through them. I'm going to start really, really simple. And the first is, why can I roll my tongue?
Okay, this is amazing. I'm so excited now.
And the first question, obviously, to you guys is, can you do that?
I can.
No, I'm right off the bat. I'm out of Ellis syndrome, which is great to hear. I took the precursory test, and I'm all clear. I took a rapid test.
That puts you in the minority of people, Tom. 65 to 81% of the population can roll their tongue, and more women than men.
Interesting.
All right, hold on. What's the percentage again? Sorry.
65 to 81%.
That's
wow.
That's such a specific.
How did they figure out what percentage it was?
This will be like a number of studies where they've sampled different population sizes and and from different areas that have come out with these different percentages.
That's a great study. You walk in and you're like, tongue. Age, location. All right, cool. You did it. You can do it. I absolutely cannot.
Well, so just for the listeners, you probably know what this is, but it's the action of bringing either side of your tongue up to make a U shape. And doing it like now.
Tom, sucks to suck.
Sucks to suck. So what do you know? Why can I roll my tongue?
I don't know.
Yeah, there's a necessary evolutionary benefit for this. It allows the human body to...
Is it essentially one of the things that, like, doesn't impact you either way, and therefore evolution hasn't gotten rid of it?
That's such a good idea. Yeah, probably. Probably.
Is it... Hold on, I also... now that I'm sort of understanding what this question is going to be like, I am realizing, like, what... What is happening there with the tongue's ability to do that? The tongue, so this is where I show my lack of knowledge. The tongue is a single muscle?
Yeah, it's a single muscle. Yeah. But if you split the tongue down the middle, which some people get as like a cosmetic surgery, they can move those two bits independently. So it's not really like the muscle in the same sense,
right.
Like a that single
has like
muscle
a single action, right? Yeah. It's more complex than... I've literally never thought about this besides as a child amusement. I've never considered
I've never
like
contemplated
why
my
what's
tongue
happening.
So much.
So neither of you were taught anything about why this was then when you
absolutely no. not. No. So I saw a few kids do it in like fourth grade and I was like, oh, I wish I could do that. And then I never thought about it.
So that's interesting because I was taught and many people I know were taught as part of when you're learning about how Mendelian genetics works, inheritance. That this is a single dominant allele inherited from a parent.
Really?
A Mendelian trait, right? That's what loads of people taught. Well, I'm here to say it's wrong.
I was going to say, it seems a little straightforward for what I feel like I feel like the lesson is it's always more complex with genetics.
Well, this is proposed by geneticist Alfred Struthavant in 1940. He did a study and some of the people he asked could roll their tongues, had parents who couldn't, but he still put this out as like a hypothesis. But then a follow-up study of 33 twins in the 1950s showed that 7 set of twins had one who could roll their tongue and one who couldn't. And Struthavant did state in a book in the 60s that the tongue rolling was not a Mendelian trait, but the myth is like very strongly perpetuated. It's pretty much like if someone knows this, if you ask them why and they do know something, they'll say that it's a single gene. Most of the time.
Wow, that's so wild. Because like, 1940, they were like, yeah, no. and for that to have so much staying power. That's really interesting, yeah.
And the important thing about all of this is, and this is good news for you, Tom, you can teach yourself to roll your tongue. There's been studies, they gave people the task to just do it every day for 30 days and most of them learn how to do it by the end of that time period.
Tom, for shits and giggles, can you learn how to roll your tongue?
Yeah, I'm something about that design of an experiment is very funny to me. Like, in my mind, I know how you just explained it, but in my mind, it's like a Stanford Prison Experiment style thing where they're like, they have to learn how to roll their tongues or else. That's...
Oh my or goodness. Someone behind a screen will be shocked to death.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of baffled and comforted that this research was done in the 40s. Like, it's, I can't believe I haven't heard about it either. This is so,
it's so bizarre,
delightful, and it but it's simultaneously like totally delightful, but also does teach you something.
Yeah.
About nature and nurture and genetics. That's so okay. I need to practice.
That's the takeaway. You better.
I want to be more like you, Ella.
That was the first. That was the first question. That was the first question of what's wrong with Ella, which is we don't know. For that first one, I would say is the answer. The second question. Why do I sneeze when I look at the sun?
No, but this why? Is... Why are we
this is
that?
Another one. This is another one. Okay, we're going to find out that I'm the antithesis of Ella, because this is another one so, I don't have.
So Tom, this doesn't happen to you. Caroline, this does happen to you.
Yeah, and I get a really, like, itchy head as well.
That's in the sun. A weird one, but fine.
There you go.
So this is an age-old question. The Book of Problems, in the Book of Problems by Aristotle. Aristotle asked,
No.
Why does the heat of the sun provoke sneezing?
What the fuck? What the fuck?
Tom's absolutely lost it.
Why doth the tongue muscle form a U formation in some people, and yet...
Not in others!
And yet I, the most intelligent, am not remaining capable as God's punishment.
Okay, so this is called photic sneeze reflex, or autos... Ready for this, Tom. You'll like this. Autosomal dominant compelling helio-ophthalmic outburst, or...
What the fuck?
You were right! I did love it! That's amazing! One more time, please.
Autosomal dominant compelling helio-ophthalmic outburst, or a chew.
A chew? Oh my god. Scientists need to stop. There, I
someone,
said it.
Acronyms were a mistake.
We should really gatekeep acronyms from the scientific community there.
I did not realize that was an acronym. I just thought it was a really long... Oh, also at that point, it's just a sentence. It's quicker to say the thing that happens when you look at the sun and sneeze than saying
photic
that.
Photic sneeze reflex.
God damn it.
Okay, okay. Do either of you have any ideas why this might happen?
Eyes close to nose.
I mean, it's a... You know what? If you think about that more internally, you know? The
like, ear, nose, throat, cavity going on in my head.
Nose cavity go idea. Up there.
You know what? This is one of the... So one of the mechanistic ideas of this is that... When
can I ask?
Go on.
All right, and Carolyn, please let me know if you have a guess. Does it have to, I mean, my guess is it's going to be like when you look at a bright light, your eyes, your pupils dilate, which contracts a muscle that is adjacent to the nose.
You know what? I think you're actually not so far off. So one of the kind of like leading mechanistic theories and hypotheses of why this is so the change in light stimulates the optic nerve and crossed wires, for lack of a better word. In the brain causes stimulation of the trigeminal nerve, which is the thing that makes you sneeze, but so it stimulates that and it makes you feel like irritated in the nose and you sneeze. So the optic nerve, the same, they get triggered accidentally at the same time basically, and that's what makes you sneeze.
Interesting.
But this, the mechanism isn't the thing I was interested in knowing. I wanted to know, you know, further back than that, the genetics of it. So 11 to 35% of the population have this.
Ooh.
And a majority of these are white females.
Love that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh.
So it's likely genetics. And if one of your parents has this, it's about a 50% chance you'll have it as well.
Interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah, right. And but the genes results for this haven't been identified because who was gonna fund that? But
Aristotle, obviously.
Well, that's what I was thinking until I saw that some researchers actually think that if you understand the genetics behind this better, it might help you to learn about how things like epilepsy are triggered, which is a very good thought.
Well, I do want to say, because it's interesting because sort of like these neurological pathways aren't what I think of initially when I think of genetics, right? Like with the tongue thing, that sort of like makes more intuitive sense to me because it's like a muscle difference maybe. But if it's a genetic, you know, again, to borrow a simplistic phrase, but like misalignment or like rewiring, that's interesting. Yeah. Right?
Well, this is the same thing as referred pain. You know, like the idea that you have, if you have a heart attack, you feel it in your arm. I think the concept is the same here. So the alignment, the misalignments come very early in development. So like so just a few genes could potentially do this. I think it's really interesting. I mean, I use these like once or twice when I look at the sun. But some people have reported seizing up to 40 times in a row.
Wow.
It sounds very hot and comfortable.
That's... At what point do they start counting? They're like, wait a second. Yeah, I should be keeping track. Hold on. Wow.
We have more questions. So that was that one. Again, we don't know.
Right. Hold on. Right now, Carolyn's at 2 for 2. I'm at 0 for 2. All right.
Why am I missing a tendon in one of my wrists?
What the fuck? What do you...
Is this the thing where, like, if you go like that, it's not there?
Wait. Okay, so we'll have to do this as an exercise together. So for the listeners at home as well. So if you flex your wrist inwards to your inner arm, about a 90-degree angle, and then you push your thumb against your fingers with some pressure, you should be able to see either one or two tendons. If you keep on pushing and like releasing, you'll see you'll see one of them flexing or two of them flexing.
I can see both of them on each wrist.
See both on each.
I have one. I think I have one on each wrist.
You have one on each wrist.
You're like making like a duck with your hand and you're bending down.
Yes, you're making a little duck face and bending in, and then do the squeeze. I can see one on one wrist and two on one wrist.
Are you? Wait, it's you have one. You have a different
have
one
a weird
for each.
Mix.
Yeah.
Interesting.
This is good. So this is interesting. So Tom, you're actually. So you're both. You're both half. You're both at a half point.
Yes, I think so.
Tom, this is particularly interesting. So this tendon, if you can see it, it's called your palmaris longus. It's a superficial weak flexor of the wrist.
So, and also just as a quick reminder, because I know, but maybe there are some listeners who don't know, a tendon is, I know the answer, but just so you can
It's not it. A muscle. It's basically attaches... at 2 points, and when you flex a muscle, it's the thing that it will pull the place it's attached to. So it's more commonly present. So it's often unilaterally absent rather than bilaterally. So if you're going to miss it, you're normally only missing it in one arm.
Okay.
Really?
So you're an anomaly.
Tom, you're the weird one. Weird one.
Whoa, I am developing psychic powers.
He's just doing duck arms right now into the camera.
We have found Tom's mundane
superpower. With like a serious face, like, whoa.
Whoa.
And what is particularly interesting is, so in about 12 to 16% of Caucasians and Hispanic people, it's absent. 5% of African Americans and 3% of Asians. So you're like a particular anomaly to not only, you're missing two and... of only 3% of people.
Fascinate. What?
So.
Okay. Cool.
It has a very long tendon and a short muscle belly.
Wait. So. I'm sorry. Just to clarify, am I missing a tendon?
Yes. Yes, but you're missing a useless tendon.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I was too busy doing the duck things to consider. wait a second. A tendon is not here.
This is like, do you know the idea that some people don't even grow wisdom teeth because their jaws are too short? Because like human jaws have evolved to be smaller over time, which is why we get people often get impacted wisdom teeth. So many people just don't even grow them anymore.
Basically, I have two.
I might have two.
This tendon this muscle tendon is normally so useless that it's often used as a donor tendon because it doesn't leave any functional deficit.
That's really interesting.
Why this happens, they just don't know because no one's looked at it.
Well, we have it so that it's like having a spare tire in your car.
That's nice.
In case anyone needs a spare tendon.
It's probably just an evolutionary like hangover because we don't need it, basically.
Oh, Tom, you have two. Tom, you have both of them.
I have two.
Yeah. Tom's less special.
Oh, Tom, you're not special at all.
I lied. I lied about having one tendon for clout. I'm canceled. This episode's going to be titled An Apology. Hi, everyone.
I have two tendons.
It was an honest mistake. I'm so sorry. I will do better in the future.
You've got to be sure to not edit out all of the parts where, like, you're crying too much to speak. You've got to keep that.
Yeah, you can't do that, Tom. Like, if there isn't all this crying in here, then, you know.
Is it really an apology?
That's another weird thing. I can't cry. That's it. Yeah. It's actually a condition.
Next question. Why don't my armpits smell?
That's really rude of you.
Yeah, I'm taking the L on this one. Once again, not like Ella.
Do you not sweat in your armpits?
You know, when you started this question, I was like, oh, I get it. It's like a fun exercise into our bodily tendencies and oddities. But now I'm like, huh. This is a very specific set.
Yes, because
does your sweat not smell?
My armpit sweat doesn't smell.
But the rest of your sweat does?
I mean, it might do. I've never tried to smell it. I'll be honest.
Ella, can you do, like, 50 jumping jacks right now and smell the sweat on your back, please?
And then waft it into the microphone?
Yeah. So that sweat wouldn't smell anyway because that's not from a type of gland that produces smell.
Oh.
There are two types of sweat glands. I can't remember how you say it, but it's like exocrine and then apocrine. Uh-huh. Apocrine glands are present in the places that are associated with sweating after puberty. Armpits, your groin. So they remain inactive until puberty. After puberty, that they start, and then that sweat is high in fat and protein. And then the bacteria comes and breaks down that in the sweat, and that's what produces a smell. So it's not that the sweat itself smells.
That's interesting. It's a bacterial relationship.
The bacteria not like your sweat then?
That's a very good question.
I was going to ask Ella, what study showed the deal with the devil you have to make to get this superpower?
Yes. Well, there's a kind of, you know, there's been a running theme here, I guess. I guess what I would ask is, do you think this is genetic or not?
Yeah, it's an interesting... I feel this makes total sense to me to be a genetic thing. Hold on, or is this something I can learn to do in a month?
Like
the temp thing.
Wow.
Have they tried an experiment where they asked people for 30 days to stop sweating? I mean, no, actually, I know this is the case because Lord knows I tried to think my way out of sweating in middle school.
Oh, no.
For a month.
So this is a 2013 paper from the University of Bristol. They looked at the genes of 6,495 white European women, and 117 of them, so 2%, carried the form of a mutated form of the ABCC11 gene, which means that they didn't produce underarm odor.
Interesting.
These people are also more likely to have dry earwax as opposed to sticky earwax.
I was going to ask about the earwax. Yeah. That is the one bodily oddity I learned about kind of recently.
So that's a question I have for either of you. What is your earwax texture?
My earwax is so sticky. My God.
Hold on. Are we at this point as podcast co-hosts that we are we're asking these questions?
We're not quite friends, but we are podcast co-hosts who know about each other's earwax. So
I have wet earwax, I guess.
Yeah, so do I. But dry earwax is more likely with this gene variant. So all I'll say is I don't think I have this gene variant because of the earwax, but also because if you leave me long enough, I will start to smell eventually, basically.
It just takes a little bit of time to get there. So,
I could, you know, go for a run and go to the gym and then wait a week, and I would then probably start smelling. So I think it's just that I have maybe I have a variant.
A degree.
A degree. Maybe you need like two alleles and I only have one or something like that, you know?
Right. Okay. You're mortal. That's good.
Yeah, I am a mere mortal. I think what is interesting. So
if you cut me, do I not bleed? If I do jumping jacks, do I not stink?
Yes. Very good.
That's Aristotle.
Comedy.
Comedy.
2% of Europeans lack this gene, but most East Asians and almost all Koreans lack this gene.
Interesting.
Huh.
So I think that's another link to say that probably this isn't the only thing that is related to sweat, like smelling sweat, mm-hmm. because it's not that all Koreans are completely odorless.
Yeah.
And this is one last fact. Although these 2% of these women in this study didn't produce body odor, 78% of them used deodorant anyway.
I love that for them.
I hate that for them. Don't do that. That's a waste of money.
Continuing to use money. They're just trying to make us feel better. Okay.
They do it for us.
Yeah. They don't want to rub it in too much, so they just rub it into their underarms instead.
This is the last question I have written down. I could go on.
Okay.
There's so many oddities, but I'll stop here.
So I'm at 0.5.
Caroline's at 2.5.
I'm at 2.5, yeah.
This is 5. This is the fifth one. Okay.
All right, let's do it.
Why does coriander...
By the way, this is the best BuzzFeed quiz we've ever done, by the way. But also continue.
Why does coriander / cilantro... tastes like soap to me.
Oh. Yay! You're one of those!
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a point for Tom.
Oh, I love coriander.
This is so interesting. Yeah.
Congrats, Tom.
And Caroline likes it. Okay, so that's...
I do like it.
Okay. Do you have any idea why, Tom? Or Caroline?
That's a genetic thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think people, when you reach a certain age, you realize the truth and you see through cilantro. We put away our childish things, like pretending that cilantro tastes good. No, I just know that this is, like, extremely divisive, because, like, it's...
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe this is because it is... You know, it's sort of interesting as we go through these, like, thinking about the different... I feel like we're doing a little tour of the body, and it's very interesting when it comes to taste how powerful that
yeah.
how divisive that is, right? Mm-hmm. Because I feel like this is... Of all of these, I think this is the one that we are aware of the most, because it's such a, like... And I feel like there's also, like, a cultural element to it, right?
I was going
to
say,
tons of foods, yeah.
Yeah. It's almost a personality trait at this point, if you like coriander or not.
Yeah,
I feel like if you don't like it, which has a really linked genetic reason and isn't just being picky, some people who like it get real mad about that.
Yeah, because we just don't understand how bad it is.
You know what? I will say, this is, of these traits, this is the first one that is subjective, which is really interesting, right? I can't prove to you that I hate the taste of it, right?
Yeah.
I can show you, I can take a picture of my tendons and send it to you, but this is one where it's perceptual, which is really interesting.
Definitely true, but I'm going to explain to you why I think you might change your mind about that a little bit through this. Okay, so this is information from 23andMe. So 23andMe, for those who don't know, is a genomics and biotech company. You provide them with a saliva sample and they genotype your DNA and provide reports on ancestry and health-related topics. And I'm going to start this spectrum with a disclaimer saying that although I was happy to hand over my data to them, it is important before you do that you understand their privacy policies in your country and if you're comfortable with what they can and can't do with your data. One of the board members of 23andMe, Patrick Chung, said they wanted to become the Google of personalized healthcare.
And we know how good Google are after today.
Yep. In a country where you might rely on health insurance companies and paid healthcare, I can see how this could be very sinister. So, although I don't feel that way in the UK, and 23andMe also say that they don't sell your data without consent, so did Google at one point.
Yeah.
So make of that what you will. I just feel like that's important to know.
No, I really appreciate that disclaimer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Saying that, 23andMe have also done a lot of really interesting research because they have so much data, and they also give this a lot of their data to universities who use it very productively.
Ah.
This, I would say, is not that productive. So my 23andMe report said that I have slightly higher odds of disliking the taste of cilantro, which turns out to be very true. It's a genetically linked dislike of coriander, and this is present in 4 to 14% of the American population.
Oh wow!
Only 4 to 14?
Yeah.
Wow.
It feels quite like it should be more
for such a loud group of people.
Oh, yeah.
Shut up! Come on.
The groan
please go on.
That that came out of both of you then was just so glorious.
This depends on ancestry. So it's lowest in South Asians, greatest in Ashkenazi Jews, for some reason.
Weird.
So it was a study by 23andMe scientists back in 2012 that identified the like specific gene responsible. So this was in a journal called Flavor.
Great.
By Erickson et al. They analysed the genomes of around 40,000 people and asked them if they like cilantro or not. I just realised I'm going to be changing between cilantro and coriander a lot here.
Are they the same?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
But I never call it cilantro. It's just this is what all of the internet says. So they found a SNP, or a single nucleotide polymorphism, which is a single change to one of the building blocks, so the A, T, G, or C in a gene.
SNP is a good acronym.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? And a single SNP associated with the soapy taste detection in coriander. And it's on a cluster of 56 olfactory receptor genes on chromosome 11. So nose receptors. And one of these genes is OR6A2. And this is a receptor that binds very specifically to a class of organic compounds called aldehydes. Aldehydes mm-hmm. are present in many forms and in many things. But it is the E2 alkanals and the N aldehydes that are present in both soap and coriander.
Whoa. Okay, yes, continue. I have not thought about genetic taste this deeply before. And like in my mind, I'm like seeing the nucleotides, and I'm like processing the molecules of like a taste or like a compound and thinking about this. So sorry, please continue.
It's okay. Well, I was just going to add, and you know what you were saying now about subjective experience in this case, although what coriander and soap taste like is subjective, that they are similar or dissimilar if you have this mutation right. and this sensitivity yeah. to it is not necessarily subjective.
Mm-hmm.
You might like the taste of soap, for example. But studies have been done since this. It showed that 11.5% of people who said that they thought that coriander tasted soapy didn't have a version of mutation. So other genes probably are involved, probably in this mm-hmm. olfactory space as well. Maybe a more aldehyde kind of detecting.
So,
genes.
Sorry, to sort of rephrase what's going on, the what causes it to be soapy is like in
the ability to detect the chemical that is in coriander that is also in soap.
So it's there.
It is there. It's not.
I just have extra perceptive taste receptors that can notice it.
Yeah, I think that is the idea. I wonder if it's also...
Interesting!
Yeah, because I think it's possible that you're not supposed to. So, yeah. Or maybe it changes your perception of it. But then again, I don't think if Caroline ate soap that would be good for them. Like, I don't think you would enjoy that.
I wouldn't want to. No.
So in a way, it's sort of like, you know, those like colorblind tests where they have like dots of different colors and like they make a number, like... I taste a number and Carolyn just doesn't. Just, sorry if that's a horrible metaphor.
So you're saying Caroline is colorblind to coriander.
Yeah, kind of.
Maybe. I think you might be right. I don't want to say for sure that it's that.
Sure.
That it's an increase. I think it is an increased sensitivity to the aldehydes in coriander.
Okay.
That makes it. So yes. You are superior.
That's all I needed to hear. Well, thank you. I need these points.
So if we look at my 23andMe data, there are two markers they highlighted in that area of 56 olfactory receptors that mm-hmm. increase my likelihood, but they're not the SNP in that original study. But it seems that they haven't published a lot of the data that they use yet. But that's... not the end of this. That is the last question.
I was going to say, just quickly, I'm amazed that one, again, feels the most straightforward. I would totally believe there's, like, a single reason for that, but you're saying that there's likely many interrelated factors that go into that.
Yes, I think that it's just that coriander, it just has that potential. So there's many there are many ways in which you could detect that.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild. Yeah.
So, but it is very, out of all of the ones we've got, it is like kind of the most simply genetically linked.
Okay, yeah.
So that's the end of the quiz. What's wrong with Ella and how related to Ella, how much Ella are you? We've got a 1.5 and a 2.5 out of 5. if you were, you know, if you were playing along, go over to head over to our Discord. Let's learn everything pod.com and let me know what's wrong with you and how much Ella is that.
It's like, hey guys, did you hear the podcast? They released a personality test to see which member of the podcast you are. It's like, oh cool, goodness. Let me see. Dude, does my sweat smell? Huh.
You're either,
next question.
You're either Ella or you're not. And then that's the option.
The two genders.
Yeah, there are two genders. Ella and the this rest of you. So, have either of you done 23andMe?
I just want to say, it's so, and I said it before, it's so especially interesting which of these are deeply subjective, because I remember, like, when the first time I heard about the earwax difference, like, I was talking with a friend and we both said the same, like, they said, like, people have wet earwax, and I said, people have dry earwax? Like, it's so, I mean, especially with these things that have to do with taste and smell, I can totally imagine going your whole life, and even as a scientist, maybe even not considering that other people might feel differently. And especially, yeah, you know, with the cilantro, like, some people think you're a picky eater, but it's really interesting to look at this.
I completely agree. It's mm-hmm. funny how, like, these incredibly small variations of genetics can, like, completely change your subjective view put on something very
your
simple.
Subjective experience as a person.
It's really cool.
Is there anything else from your 23andMe that's worth mentioning?
It says that I'm an elite power athlete.
Lucky
I'm sorry?
You. Oh my god, I didn't know we had an athlete in the group.
It says
wow.
My muscle composition is common in elite power athletes, so...
Oh my god.
Oh, this is... Ella, I'm so glad you included this sort of, like, disclaimer at the end that sometimes some of this stuff isn't necessarily true. It's very nice that you did that. I appreciate it, yeah. So in conclusion, none of this is for...
yeah, and...
take it for granted.
But I do the disclaimer that the stuff on 23andMe is... a lot of it's preliminary research, right?
Based, yeah.
And there is correlation versus causation. So, thanks, guys.
Thank you so much for that. That was really great. Fun. It was great talking about what was wrong with you.
Thanks.
You know,
I've always wondered.
So has everyone else. I phoned my mum just before coming on with you guys, and she was like, "What question are you doing today?" Then Ella, and I was like, "Oh, I'm gonna say what's wrong with Ella." And he's like, "I've always wanted to know."
I want to do a little preface for this section that it's surprisingly hard to find information about the history of tests and quizzes and things like that, because every time you Google it, the internet tries to give you a test or a quiz rather than any information about tests or quizzes.
Oh, yeah. The keywords don't work very well.
It's not ideal together. Also, there's a lot of mystery around, like, the history of quizzes in general, so I'm going to be really clear that some of this stuff... there's a lot of speculation around it, and if any of the information isn't entirely correct, we will let you know, basically.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's just my little preface. So, tests of knowledge have obviously been around for thousands of years at this point. The website Britannica suggests that tests can be traced back to around the Han Dynasty, which is 206 BCE to 220 CE, where apparently candidates for civil service positions were tested to determine whether they had memorized 9,000 Chinese characters.
Interesting.
This system, which became institutionalized during this period, but could be traced back hundreds of years further, evolved into this examination lasting 3 days and two nights.
That's awful.
It's grossies, isn't it?
Grossies.
Whoa.
I just want to add, this is, we're adding this to the list of the history of useless things that Caroline has
absolutely
got.
Yes.
Yeah, great.
Loving
I love it.
I'm loving it.
Love this for you.
So, obviously these tests...
A 3 days, two night long test.
They have to stay there overnight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, awful, right?
You know what? I just realized something, and maybe this is something you'll talk about. It's very interesting how... I despise tests, but love trivia.
Quizzes.
Yeah.
Actually, that's not something I was going to talk about. I was going to talk a little bit about, like, the joy of the pub quiz in the UK, but not specifically about, like, that aspect of it. So maybe we'll get into it, like, a little bit later when we're chatting about it.
Yeah,
but it's
yeah,
so interesting,
curious.
Isn't it? In terms of tests for fun or quizzes or trivia stuff, I sort of assumed that you'd be able to trace this back to, like, the ancient Romans or the ancient Greeks.
Well, I was going to say, maybe there was one guy in the Han Dynasty that was, like, really hyped
yeah,
about it.
Yeah, maybe he was really down for it.
All right, all night, let's go. Oh, everyone else, it's just me. I hate it too. Yeah, oh, God. How many characters? Only 900. I mean, 900 is a lot, actually.
Oh, it's actually 9,000, but yeah,
9,000.
Still.
Okay, that's, boy.
But that was sort of my thinking was, like, these civilizations that were, like, such a, like, almost breeding ground of intelligence and, like, intelligent thought didn't, or there's no evidence of them doing tests for fun and quizzes and things like that. Like, if you look at, like, there's basically Britannica says that there's no evidence that any of these groups did tests for fun, which I just think is so bizarre, because we are in such, like, a state of mind where we love doing these things, and those groups didn't. I thought that was weird, but anyway... We're now delving in to the obscure history of the word quiz itself. Because it's a relatively new word, it dates back to around the 1780s or the 1790s.
That's very new.
Yeah. And it was initially used to describe a peculiar object or a peculiar person.
Quizzical. That's quizzical. A quizzical thing.
Oh.
There you go, yeah. So, when did we stop using the word quiz to mean a peculiar person or object? When did it start meaning test? Again, there are a few different dates thrown around there. We don't entirely know. But according to Merriam-Webster, it was used in the early 1800s in the verb sense to question closely and the related noun sense of a brief oral or written test. Charles Dickens used the word quizzing in one of his works called Sketches by Boz, which was published between 1833 and 1836.
Okay.
And the word quiz first appeared in print in 1867, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, when it applied specifically to a set of questions used to evaluate a person's knowledge in an academic context.
Cool.
So we've still not quite gotten to fun quizzes yet. We are still at, like, the academic sense of the word quiz or test.
Yeah. You gotta make the jump from pop quiz to pub quiz.
Exactly, yeah. So there are hints that quizzes, not necessarily using the word quiz, but more fun-styled questions, like, being a thing back in, like, 1691. That was where a man named John Dunton, who was a London bookseller, launched the Athenian Gazette, which asked readers to send in questions, and the answers would then be supplied by Dunton and his friends. So it wasn't really for, like, everybody to enjoy. It was just for him and his pals to be able to, like, see if they could answer the questions.
That's a fun inversion where it's like, ask me a question and see if you can answer.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
It's really cool, isn't it? But my favorite,
kind of like that,
early example of something, like, along the veins of a quiz becoming a thing is the 1884 book published by American Albert Southwick. So it's titled Quizzism and Its Key, Quirks and Quibbles from Queer Quarters, a melange of questions in literature, science, history, biography, mythology, philology, geography, etc., etc., with their answers.
Could you say that first bit again? Just the before the colon?
Please don't make me do this again.
The tongue twister part.
Yeah,
please
on.
Don't make me do this
yeah,
again.
Do it.
Quizzism and Its Key, Quirks and Quibbles from Queer Quarters.
Now three times fast.
Can I will say though, what's really funny is that that punniness feels like a core part of quiz
yes,
culture, you know, like a silly quiz
yeah,
quizziness.
So some of, because this was published in like 1884, some of the questions are very obviously of their time, but some of them are still really good questions, such as question number 12 in the book.
Oh, yay. Do we get to try and get answer?
You do! So this question asks, what is the origin of the superstition concerning the number 13?
Oh, what a good question.
It's a great one,
wow,
isn't it?
Hold on.
Which, quite frankly, could have been an entire miscellaneous topic in its own right. So, yeah, what do you guys think?
I have no idea.
Is it biblical?
So that is one of the answers given by this book.
Okay.
Around the story of Jesus at the Last Supper. And there being 13. There we go, yeah. The other answer that the book gives is that during 1660 and 1678, the death rate in London was 1 in 12.5. So there became this superstition that you couldn't have 13 people around for dinner because somebody might die.
Oh, wow.
That's fun.
It's really, really interesting, isn't it? Wow.
Textbook fun.
I mean, that is... I'm not going to detract what I said. I will absolutely tell people that with some glee.
Oh, yeah. Well, because those are kind of like the only two answers we have right now. So I think you should spread those both around. Yeah. So books like this existed in the background, but none of them ever really generated a lot of public interest. It wasn't until the formation of bees that the quiz...
Bees? Like,
that we...
Sorry, what?
So,
like spelling bees.
Like spelling bees. Aww. Spelling bees were one of the earliest formats of quizzes in terms of them being in rounds, even having like sound in the background to be like if you got a question right or a question wrong. Like this was a really early point of quizzes for fun taking a hold.
That's interesting.
So the BBC's 1938 Transatlantic Spelling Bee.
The BBCB.
It's one of the really early examples of this, which was a spelling match between Harvard University and Radcliffe College against students of Oxford. The American team won by 28 correct spellings versus
Let's
24.
Go!
Well, why didn't you put a fucking American spelling bee on the moon?
There is a great clip in the show notes of this event as well, so it's well worth just having a little watch about it, because you can hear all of like the sound effects in the background when somebody gets a question wrong and things. It's a really, really fun watch. It's only a couple of minutes long. So whilst this isn't a quiz per se, it really did introduce the general public to the idea of something, again, like in rounds with all of these things. And it was popular enough to spawn other subsequent bees, including the general knowledge bee, which was between school children from Lancashire and Yorkshire here in the UK.
Yay!
And that's essentially like the birth of quizzes.
That's a British history joke for all those people, right there.
So, not long after that, bees and quizzes become more popular, especially over the radio, during the 1930s and 1940s.
Oh!
After World War II, and particularly with the rise of the television in the UK and America, the TV quiz show grew in popularity.
Gosh, we've got a lot of them.
Wow, I'm just... Yeah, I
so
just...
So many of them.
I'm just realizing, yeah, like the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire of the world.
Yeah.
The like, wow, I hadn't considered...
Or the...
Huh, there's a lot.
You might not know this one, Tom, but what is considered the top tier quizzing show in the UK, which is University Challenge.
I don't know this, no.
University Challenge is one that actually came up quite a few times during the research for this.
Can I ask, is Jeopardy in the UK? Is that as big?
No, we don't have
it's
Jeopardy
not
at
as
all.
Big, no.
Really? Jeopardy's beloved.
Mm-hmm. I think most people are aware of it because we get a lot of American culture here, but we don't have it on the TV.
Wild.
So, and actually, Jeopardy was one of the ones, there was sort of a resurgence of it again in like the 1960s, and that again was one of the earlier ones that still exists. But University Challenge also falls into that category for the UK. It was one of the really, really early ones that was formed. It got cancelled for a little bit and it came back in the 2000s, maybe late 1990s, and it's stuck around ever since.
I hate University Challenge. I just want to say that straight up.
Such strong emotions about this.
It's not fun. It's pretentious. And
it is.
It's just a bunch of colleges from Oxford and Cambridge fighting each other out, basically.
Yeah.
Jeopardy, you answer with a question. It's fun.
Jeopardy's very fun. I like it a lot more.
So, speaking of American-inspired commercial television shows, that makes its way to the UK, and things like Double Your Money and Take Your Pick first start airing in 1955 here in the UK on ITV. And I hate to do this to you, but the rise of these, the popularity of these shows on TV is supposedly the origin of the pub quiz.
I believe that.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
It is odd.
In that I would...
Yeah, I would have thought it was the other way around as well.
Yeah. Although, yeah. I will say, like, there is something very, like, in some ways, this totally checks out, like, because it's very... It feels like a very... Like, what made me think of it, Carolyn, was when you talked about, like, the buzzersness and, like, the sound effects. Like, mm-hmm. there is something very performative about... a quiz like that makes sense, that like there are like TV-esque aspects of it.
Yeah,
that's really interesting.
And I read, this is going back to when it was just on the radio, there was this idea or one of these theories that the quizzes became so popular because it allowed normal people to be on the radio when usually it would just be radio hosts and things like that.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, that's nice, yeah.
So I just, that's a really nice bit of info.
For me, the part, it's that, and then also the one where people were submitting quizzes for a person to answer that really strike a fun chord in me, that it's like, the fun aspect of it where it's like, I know this little thing. Do you know this whole thing?
I know this bit of information, yeah.
I do want to say that I think that there must be some kind of, like, intimate crossover here between pub quizzes and crosswords. Because, like, crosswords are just, in essence, a kind of quiz, right?
Yeah, they are,
The earliest forms of them are just general knowledge. It's just trivia.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was gonna ask is, I feel like there's an interesting, indirect... a lineage between riddles and quizzes, which I feel like,
ooh,
you know,
yeah.
really, the first pub quiz was the Sphinx? Question mark? I feel like they're a little different.
No, but I know, I don't know. I think that's like, I don't know, that maybe I've just been around you for too long, Tom, but that made a lot of sense.
Back to how the pub quiz actually started. There are a few different theories. I'm going to talk about one theory today, but there is another theory, which again is in the show notes. So if you want to go and check that out, I don't have time to talk about it here today. But that will be there. But one theory that goes around quite a lot is that it's believed that pubs were one of the earliest places to have TVs accessible to the public in the UK before they were really, really common in people's homes.
Wow.
So people would go to the pub to watch the TV. And obviously, during 1955, when these quiz programs are on the TV, people are sat in the pub watching them. Possibly after a few beers, shouting out the answers at the telly.
That is a beautiful lineage, mm-hmm. that it comes from, like, watching it to being like, what if we did that? Like,
what if
I love
we did
that.
Yeah. Literally, yeah. That. Yeah. It is super lovely.
And I'm sure bartenders appreciated that more than when they would put on rugby and then they would all say, we should do that right now in the pub.
So, that is the sort of origin. Pub quizzes became a thing really as they are now in the 1950s and 1960s. They then really, really boomed in the 70s and 80s. Particularly thanks to two people named Sharon Burns and Tom Porter, who essentially standardised the production of pub quiz materials.
Hmm.
They established a company called Burns and Porter, who provided publicity documents, league tables, and quizzes that had verified questions and answers. And it made it super easy for pub owners to be able to hold these quizzes for themselves. So the Burns and Porter quiz started off with just 30 teams and ended up with around 10,000 people participating each week.
Wow.
This thing really caused it to boom up, basically.
I will say it's, you know, I feel like we live in a world where you can Google or find like a collated list of quiz questions. But like at the time, like what were pubs supposed to do? Just like their bartenders come up with questions and be like, so that's a really interesting resource.
Mm-hmm. You'd essentially have to hope that somebody was willing to put the time and effort into making a quiz for you.
Yeah.
And this meant that everyone could do it, basically. That's which neat. Is really, really like cool. That. So skipping forward, I want to talk a little bit about the pandemic, unfortunately, because that could have been the death of the pub quiz, especially with pubs having to close for really long periods of time. Yet things like Facebook groups and YouTube channels like Jay's Virtual Pub Quiz, I had to mention him today, obviously, just essentially kept the pub quiz going. And I think Jay's Virtual Pub Quiz is possibly one of the biggest ones now, but there was so many.
I don't know what this is.
So it's a YouTube channel. It started off as a Facebook page. Again, I don't have time to talk about this man's backstory. His name's Jay Flynn. But it's so fascinating and well worth a read. Again, there's a link in the show notes. So this man, basically, he made a Facebook group for his friends to do a pub quiz. He accidentally got the Facebook settings wrong and he woke up on a Monday morning and had 800 people signed up to do his quiz.
I love that.
He now does weekly pub quizzes. I think it might be twice a week. And his YouTube page is amazing. I think it's got 197,000 followers. His page has now raised over £700,000 for charity.
Aww.
And everyone from Matt Smith and Billy Piper from Doctor Who to our current Prime Minister Boris Johnson have participated in his quizzes in some way. I just think that's really, really amazing.
It is.
Yeah.
I had no idea that was such a big part of the culture.
It is
that's
now
wild.
A huge thing. Well, it was a huge thing beforehand, but I feel like now it is so accessible to everyone. And I just think that pub quiz is such a weird thing. Like, because you either really, really don't care about them or you really, really love them and there's not much middle ground. But I think now especially, there's such an amazing way to interact with other people in a way that you don't really have to interact with other people, but there's like a little bit of competition. It's kind of nice. It's a great way to interact with your local community if you are going to a physical pub quiz. And I just think it's really cool that something that essentially started off at shouting at the telly after a few pints has become this huge cultural phenomenon that's literally like thrived through a global pandemic.
I just want a quick level set. Like, how into pub trivia are y'all?
Not loads. I probably go like, I would say once a month to a pub quiz.
That's more than I think the standard person would in the US anyway.
And then there's like the cafe just on the corner of my thing does like a student pub quiz every month or something.
Every pub in the UK will have a pub quiz at least once a week.
Yeah.
Wow. I feel like there's like a handful I think New York City of the cities is maybe is the city that would have it the most. And even then it's not like every pub would do that. So, and you know, I'm also a recent convert to pub trivia. I had some. I love it as an excuse to get to see my friends, and we all have different levels of stakes in it. I think we have some people in the group who are like, we gotta do this. We take it very seriously. We have other people who are like, it's just nice to see my friends.
Yeah,
and I stand somewhere in the middle of there. Yeah,
it is a way that I use to see my friends, but like we all have our like particular strengths and weaknesses in different areas, which makes it like we're a strong pub quiz team, honestly. But I did lose. I went to one 4 days ago. It was a Lord of the Rings specific quiz. I've got a big fucking gripe, right? Okay, so. It asked who was Sauron's master, what was his name, which everyone knows is Melkor or Morgoth.
Or
Melkor. They're the same person. They're different languages for the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And we put Melkor down, and the quizmaster would not let us have it. He was like, no, it's Morgoth. I'm like, they're the same person. And that was the worst pub quiz I've ever been to. And they wouldn't even let me have it. He said,
pretentious quiz
master. You can have Gollum and Sméagol, they're the same person, but Melkor and Morgoth aren't. My Lord of the Rings fans know what's up.
Wow. another aspect I love about pub quizzes is like assembling a team of like people who have like, we had we were at this pub trivia place and one of our friends' older neighbors who is in her like, you know, in her like 60s just like happened to stroll on by and was like, you can just hop on our team. And she'd be like, oh, I don't know. And then we hit this music section and she knew every single one. And nice. She just like happened to stop by was like, oh, I don't know. And I think that's really a beautiful aspect of these is that like the range of trivia is very cool.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And mm-hmm. you know what I think is a beautiful aspect? Crushing your enemies.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I mean, your opponents.
Through the power of teamwork.
Through the power of teamwork. It's Review Corner. Woo!
It certainly is. And normally we have a theme for it every time. But today's theme is actually going to be provided by the review. So this is a review from DiGiorno. And they go, to be sung to the tune of We've Got Everything by Modest Mouse. I don't know the song super well, so I'm just going to say the lyrics. Let's learn everything. They learn everything, including weird science. So I guess you'll hear everything. If you're going out to sea, download all of the apps. That's a smooth sail for you. Carolyn's got their frogs, drawing them past noon. Tom's TikToks are going viral, psychomming it to you. Ella's PhD is gonna be real, obtainable very soon. You'll learn everything. We'll learn everything from moon junk to crosswords. So I guess let's start listening. 5 hearts out of 5.
Oh, that was amazing.
That was amazing. Who did this for us?
DiGiorno, which I'm really hoping is a anime reference combined with DiGiorno's being DiGiorno.
DiGiorno, regardless. Thank you. Wonderful.
That was delightful. Thank you so much.
No one's ever written song lyrics for me.
And I'm happy that this is how it's begun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Anyway.
The people who leave reviews for us are always just, like, so on it, right? They're so on point. Like, they just... Oh.
They really are. 10 out of 10 every single time.
I do also just love a little simple review that just says, I like this.
Oh, yes, we also... It's all very good. You don't have to do song lyrics.
Does anyone have any plugs or shout-outs?
I'll plug myself. I'm Caroline the Bug everywhere. I am Caroline the Bug everywhere. So.
You say this every week. I am Big Science Energy on TikTok. I'm Ella Hubber on Twitter. And please wait around. News soon about... That's good English. News about new TikTok channel. Professional TikTok channel.
Ooh. Exciting.
And I'm Tom Lum Person everywhere.
Yay!
So, today, we learned about the Turing test and what the Turing test has become. We learned about all the things that make Ella weird, from sweat to tendons. And we learned about how pub trivia has become a delightful sensation and a joy. And you can join us all next time, where we will learn about... Everything!
Let's Learn Everything is independently produced and hosted by Ella Hubber, Tom Lum, and Caroline Roper. Editing and music by the wonderful and talented Tom Lum.
I'm so in time with it, aren't I? With the
nailed it.
Can't wait to hear it in the edit. We'll see.
I don't think I ever get this far in the podcast when I'm listening to it. Do you fade us in? Do you fade us out so you can hear us doing our last bits of talking?
It depends if it's worth hearing.
So if it's me just going, do, 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 do. That's...
Sometimes it leads into the end bit, the hidden audio.
Yes,
at the
end. Do. Actually, to be fair, I think I just skip quite far. I always listen to the end bit, but I think I just skip all the shit at the end.
That's funny. Of your own show.
My own show.